DW.
Of course, actual violence and actual discrimination has to be vigorously punished when it occurs, and speech that has a clear connection to violence, such as a true threat, that clearly should be punished. What's debated is, suppose it is solely hateful ideas that does not have such a tight and direct causal connection to violence. And I, and like many Americans, are very, very personally concerned about Nazism. I am the daughter of a Holocaust survivor who was born in Berlin, who was doing forced labor in the Buchenwald forced labor camp, became within a hair's breadth of losing his life there. So I have a great personal stake in watching what happens in Germany, as well as in my own country and around the world. And I really do believe that the most effective way to counter those dangerous ideas is not through censorship. I think censorship is morally satisfying, but its track record has failed, as we see in Germany and other European countries.
If I think now from the media standpoint, often editorially, there's always a discussion about, wait a minute, do we want to talk to this person? Do we want to give him a platform to vent his hatred? Is this something we want to do? It's always something that journalists talk about, and different journalists have different takes on it. But the way I understood you, you would also let these people express their views and try and combat it with logic and with argument rather than censor it.
I would say certainly not censor it, unless it reaches the level of specifically, you know, directly causing specific imminent serious harm. But in any particular situation, you have to make a strategic judgment about what is the most effective way to counter it. So,
because you won't get a neo-Nazi in German public radio or on German public television. It just won't happen. You have talk rounds, you have all the established parties there, maybe someone from the AfD who's more moderate, but a neo-Nazi in a German talk show, that's almost unheard of.
Well, I would say if this is somebody who is wielding actual political influence, it is really important for people to hear that, right?
And about the neo-Nazi off the street? Someone like, if you took someone out of this demonstration from Chemnitz, then it's not so justified to have him on? It would have to be a politician.
I think you want to do it in a way that is serving a positive, constructive function. So informing people of what the ideas are so they can understand that this is a serious problem, but also in particular situations, it might be the most strategic decision to ignore them and not give them the platform that they're seeking. So in the United States, we have a very effective, respected organization called the Southern Poverty Law Center, came out of the civil rights movement, and since the middle of the last century has been tracking hate groups in the United States. And their advice to college campuses, where we have seen an upsurge in efforts by white supremacists to recruit on college campuses, and you've probably seen publicity about, you know, incidents of violence, incidents of attempted censorship, loud protests and disruptive protests. And the Southern Poverty Law Center has begged students, saying, please, we know it can feel morally satisfying to confront the white supremacists in that way, but you're just feeding into their wish to get attention. The most effective thing you can possibly do is to ignore them. You don't confront them, don't debate them. If you want to do something to express a different idea, then have your own independent event far away that would celebrate affirmatively the values of diversity and equality and inclusivity. So it's a strategic decision about how we use our freedom of speech in each particular situation. When I was talking about reaching out to racist. I was thinking more of a one-on-one, and there are people, including people who do this online, just ordinary human beings who are humane and dedicated, but then there are some who are experts in psychology and social psychology who have really made it a mission to reach out specific to, on an individual by individual basis, engage sustained conversations with even committed avowed racists, and they have had great success in wooing them away from that hateful ideology.
Nadine, if you just touched upon it, university debating culture, or debating culture in general, if you also look at the media, do you get a sense that people these days are more comfortable demonizing and labeling their opponents rather than actually seeking an honest and open debate with them? And if that's the case, how dangerous do you think such a development is for an open society and democracies in general?
It has been a growing problem in the United States, and I know in other countries around the world as well. In society and the political system in general, and campuses in particular, this, what many sociologists call tribalism, that people will identify so strongly with their, in the United States, their political party is very important, their candidate. And then there, it's tied up also with what we call identity politics, that who you are in terms of race and religion and gender, and it's just becoming more and more complicated, that there's, first of all, a fear of people who have different ideas or different backgrounds. There's also an increasing fear of unwittingly saying something that is perceived as insensitive, even though you have no negative intent. And this is another reason why I believe a punitive approach is really counterproductive, Neil. Yes, there are people who are out and out explicit racists, but I believe in your country and mine and around the world that this is a small minority. A lot of people who are punished under European-style hate speech laws and in the United States are subject to severe criticism and denunciation are people who have just used a word that wasn't seen as so sensitive, or they've blurted out something in a tweet that was stupid, but they're not bad people.
If I understood you correctly, not only have we got, well, it's sort of intensifying the hate that we're witnessing these days, but on the other hand, people are also becoming more sensitive, well, self-censoring themselves because they're frightened of saying something wrong.
We are walking on eggshells. So much self-censorship there are, and particularly on these critically important issues in all of our societies, race and religion and immigration and refugees and gender identity. These are the most critically important, most hotly debated topics in our political system. They're the ones where we should have the freest, frankest, most candid, uncensored debates, and that's where people are frightened to open their mouths.
And could it also be that exactly these people that are self-censoring themselves, they could be the haters of tomorrow then?
I'm not so much concerned about that, but as I am a lost opportunity to increase understanding. I think this self-censorship leads to self-segregation, right? You're probably more frightened to speak to a member of a different racial group or different gender identity or ethnic background for fear of unwittingly insulting that person. That means we're losing the opportunity to build friendships and the one-on-one relationships, which social scientists again say by far the most effective way to overcome any kind of prejudice is to actually have contact.
But that could also, what you just described, I mean, this that could be also very frustrating for people. I mean, if they're bottling up, perhaps it's their own views and they just can't find the platform anymore to talk about it. couldn't that also push the people towards, you know, these groups that are then far more radical and actually go out onto the street and demonstrate for something in a very maybe nasty fashion?
That's an excellent point, Neil. For certain people, I have no doubt that would, in fact, be the motivating factor. And we hear that in the United States, people who have joined white supremacist groups or even people who support the racist rhetoric that we hear from our president say they love the fact that he is, for example, what they call politically incorrect. He gets away with saying what they wish they could get away with saying. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, you're helping me add to the list of the benefits of free and candid discussion and the detriments of censorship. In this country, people are self-censoring just for fear of social criticism or ostracism. In the rest of the world, shall we say, you have a greater reason to self-censor, which is you may actually be criminally prosecuted or subject to some kind of civil legal penalty for saying the wrong thing. And, you know, it's not just the most blatant, violent, targeted insults against members of minority that are punishable and punished under European-style hate speech laws. It's expressing an idea, you know, saying something about a public policy issue.
Can you please name an example for our listeners?
Absolutely. So, I mean, my favorite one, and I'm saying that ironically, was a couple of years ago in France, where the head of a Parisian gay rights organization was criminally prosecuted, convicted, and subject to a very heavy fine. Fortunately, she was not imprisoned for using the word homophobe to describe the head of an anti-gay rights organization. Homophobe was considered to be a type of hate speech. And in Germany, I think my favorite example there was a historian who wrote a letter to another historian, and the second historian turned the letter over to the police because he thought that one of the observations in the letter was trivializing the Holocaust in some way. And that was subject to criminal punishment because the German laws, as is true for many of the other laws, extend even to private communications, a letter between two historians. So I'm not sure how much publicity these incidents get in your country. Under the new, let me cite something very, very recent, the new net hate speech law that went into effect on January 1st in Germany. Of course, the first two communications that were subject to punishment under it were statements by leaders of the AfD party. And again, I think these are people who have political power. What possible good is done in a democracy of stifling them from saying what they think?
Your message is clear. You definitely are a very staunch defender of free speech and very critical of censorship. Do you think this is something that will prevail, free speech, or is it a losing battle given how things are shaping in certain countries around the globe?
If I could amend your statement, Neil, which I take as a compliment to be a staunch defender of free speech, I am an equally staunch opponent of hate. My book is called Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. So the only verb in that title is resist. I care as fully about resisting hate. You know my personal history with a father who was almost exterminated thanks to Nazism in Germany. And I've been a passionate supporter of human rights in this country and around the world. In this country, the civil rights movement was considered to be hateful and dangerous and threatening. And our strong protection of free speech only came to the fore in the context of the civil rights movement to stop Southern communities from imprisoning. Martin Luther King wrote his famous letter from a Birmingham jail. Why? Because his speech was considered dangerous. Today, you have politicians in this country saying Black Lives Matter advocacy is hate speech. They want Black Lives Matter to be treated as a hate group by those who monitor these groups. So we have to acknowledge that, you know, it is such a subjective concept, as you said earlier, and therefore we cannot trust any government official, or for that matter, any private sector media company, a social media company, to decide which ideas are we deem to be hateful and therefore should be suppressed. So I think the only hope for any kind of human rights is through robust free speech. And as an activist and as somebody who's lived quite a long time now, I am very optimistic that in the long run, all of this freedom and equality will prevail as being mutually reinforcing.
This report was brought to you by DW.